Find all sorts of opinions and add your own at RN Online.
On RN, on the ABC mobile app, online at abc.net.au and via podcast, I'm Paul Barclay. This is Big Ideas. Tonight, drugs, addiction and the brain.
But to this day, I still occasionally have a recurring dream which is about don't do it. Yeah. And it's a dream in which I'm walking down a street full of filled syringes. They're thick on the ground. In my dream, I walk and walk going, no, 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 no. And then eventually I'm so tired of resisting that I pick one up and I'm about to inject it. And I wake up and every single time I think, oh, thank God, yeah. It was just a dream.
Why do so many people use drugs when they know the risks? Should drug use be a criminal offence? Is addiction a disease? It's extremely difficult to have a calm and measured conversation around these sorts of questions. Just recently, Greens leader Richard Di Natale, a former drug and alcohol clinician, made the observation that treating drug use as a criminal matter rather than a health matter clearly isn't working. One newspaper reporting on the story ran the headline, "Push to legalise ice use." We do talk a lot these days about the scourge of ice or methamphetamine use, but it's worth taking a step back and examining the nature of substance addiction itself. What does it mean to be addicted? Why do some succumb to dependency and others not? What role does the brain play in addiction and kicking the habit? The accepted wisdom is that addiction to heroin or ice or alcohol, even prescription drugs, is a disease, a brain disease. And because it's a disease, it should be treated as such. Addicts should not be blamed for their addiction. It's not their fault. They're not weak or bad or morally flawed. Rather, they have a condition that should be medicalized and treated by clinicians. You can even see how drug use alters the brain. Proof, say the neuroscientists, of the brain disease model of addiction. This also explains why so many addicts relapse when they try to quit. While all of this sounds entirely plausible, not everyone is buying it, as you're about to hear. Dr. Mark Lewis is a developmental neuroscientist and professor. He's also a former drug addict and author of Memoirs of an Addicted Brain and The Biology of Desire, Why Addiction is Not a Disease. Wayne Hall is a professorial fellow and NHMRC Australia fellow in addiction neuroethics at the University of Queensland's Centre for Clinical Research and at the Brain Institute. He has a bunch of other impressive titles and has advised the WHO on matters related to drug use and treatment. And Kate Holden, who you heard at the very top of the program, is a former heroin addict and sex worker, a past life she's written and spoken about in her acclaimed memoir, In My Skin. Kate is a writer whose work appears in newspapers and magazines and is author of The Romantic, Italian Nights and Days. Together, all four of us are in conversation in Brisbane at the State Library of Queensland. So, Mark, the American Society of Addiction Medicine defines addiction as a primary chronic disease of brain, reward, motivation, memory, and related circuitry.
Right.
Why do you take issue with this?
Right. And so does the National Institutes of Health, who fund 90% of the addiction research in the world. There's a lot of power and there's a lot of gravity behind that position. Their first premise is that brains change with addiction, and there's all kinds of investigations of how they change, the cellular mechanisms and the protein transfers and all that stuff. I take exception, first of all, because the brain is supposed to change. The way the brain learns is through change. It's the only way it can learn. So, you know, you don't want your pancreas or your lungs or your heart to change their pathways very much over your lifespan, but you do want your brain to change, and it changes massively throughout childhood, adolescence, adulthood. This is the study of neuroplasticity, which, you know, has become fairly popular with Norman Doidge and stuff. So that's the first thing. The second thing is they call it a chronic brain disease, which means that it stops changing and it never changes again. And that's pretty unfortunate. I think that that's rather limiting and a fatalistic approach to something which I consider to be a learned habit. So when you learn how to do something like play the violin or drive a taxi in London, or you fall in love with whoever you're in love with. There's a lot of brain change going on, and the deeper the habit is and the more it's motivated by strong emotions, the more extensive the neuronal connections are going to be, the more extensive the supporting synaptic structure is going to be, and it's going to continue to perpetuate itself, to reinforce itself as you continue to have experience. That's how we learn, that's how we develop habits, and those habits include addiction, which is a very bad habit.
It is the case, though, isn't it, that chronic habitual use of drugs and the surges of dopamine mucks up the brain's reward system. But what you're saying is that that messing up of the brain does not constitute a disease.
Mucking it up. Already a bit
that's,
of a...
That's my medical terminology.
Well, it's not that far off. I mean, they say it hijacks the brain. So, you know, these metaphors are in abundance. But, you know, it's already taking a pretty strong moral position. People who take antidepressants for 20 years, oh, their brains aren't considered to be mucked up. But nevertheless, their circuitry is changing over a period of time. When you fall in love, your brain changes. Not only does it change a lot, but it changes in almost exactly the same ways as when you become addicted. You get a lot of dopamine uptake to the striatum, this goal-oriented part in the middle. And other goals fall off the radar, which means the pathways that represent those other goals start to become used less, and the pathways become pruned.
So desire is doing this to our brains.
It's all about desire.
So, Wayne, despite what Mark has just said, the brain disease model of addiction is still in the ascendancy, isn't it? And has been pretty much since the 1990s. Why is that?
Well, for the reason Mark mentioned, that the major funders of research are in the US, the National Institute on Drug Abuse, the National Institute for Alcoholism and Alcohol Abuse. And the directors of both those centres can afford to buy space in leading journals like Nature and Science to promulgate their views. The sort of dissident view, and I more or less endorse what Mark has had to say, the sceptics about the brain disease model, which include myself, find it hard to get a hearing. Mm. And there are a lot of people who prefer not to express these sorts of views if they want to continue to be funded to do research in the US. So I think there is a variety of reasons for it. I think the other strong reason, I think, in the push for it, the humanitarian sort of motive for it, is really to improve the situation of addicted individuals, and I very much support that. But I think we can do that in ways without having to buy the idea.
And it has done that, has it?
I don't think it's arguable that it has. If you look at public opinion, the extent to which people buy the idea that addiction and depression and alcohol dependence and other things are a result of changes in the brain, it doesn't improve people's attitudes. They particularly want to stay away from people who've got this intractable brain disease that's irreversible. Mm. I mean, I think the sort of pessimistic overtones that go along with that are counterproductive.
And there are ways in which we can disprove the brain disease model. One of them is we can see that when very small financial rewards or incentives are offered to addicts, it actually does significantly reduce drug use amongst them. Whereas if it was a disease, then one imagines that would not be the case, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a sort of a view that if it's all between your ears and it's a result of compulsive behaviour that you've got no control over, it does sort of understate the extent to which people can change their behaviour with lots of support. It's not easy. I mean, I think where we'd probably agree with the sort of view is that taking large doses of drugs chronically does change brain function in ways that make it hard for people to stop. And addiction can be a chronic condition. There certainly are individuals who do find it very, very difficult to stop and who develop long-term forms of addiction. But if you look more broadly, there's a much more broader spectrum, and there's a lot of people who've recovered and who've done so without requiring special treatment. And I think that's what gets lost in the sort of narrow focus on the sort of chronic collapsing brain disease conception.
Is this just a semantic point? Why is it important to make this distinction about whether it's a disease or not?
Yeah, no, if I thought it was just a word game, I would have given it up long ago. The disease model has really powerful implications for treatment, and you brought that up a few minutes ago. The thing is, the kind of rehab industry that has evolved and that construes addiction as a disease doesn't work very well. It just is not very effective. And what can doctors actually do for addicts? Well, they can prescribe medications. And some of those medications will reduce craving temporarily. Some of them will replace opiates, but not other drugs. So it's only good for actually a fairly small percentage of addictions. And that's about it. The other kinds of interventions that seem to be very effective are psychological, social interventions, cognitive interventions, motivational interventions, as you said, contingency management, changing the reward structure, changing environments. It's got nothing to do with medicine. And that's why it's not just a word game.
Kate, is it at all helpful for you to think of your past addiction as a disease?
I didn't experience it as a disease, I have to say. I feel that this might be a boring discussion because we're all going to furiously agree for an hour. But what Mark and Wayne are both saying absolutely, you know, bears on my experience, and it's fascinating to hear their neurological explanations for this, because I experienced my 5 years on heroin on an emotional level and as a physical dependency accompanied by disordered thinking. So for me, I experienced it very much as a kind of a surge of being dragged along on this surfing wave that I was not in control of, but at the same time desperately scrabbling for some kind of foothold from which I could start to revise my situation. It was so emotional for me. I was driven by, well, in the first place, the hope of social acceptance and so on, and trying to prove myself, something to myself, and the kind of young people's emotional issues, which are probably quite typical of a lot of uptake of drugs. But then was driven by a total fear of missing out, which is a fairly common phenomenon, which happened to intersect with a drug like heroin, which has a ferocious physical dependency eventually. And so what became a physical requirement of my existence was accompanied by a very strong emotional push, which was namely absolute terror of what would happen if I stopped taking it. And so I spent 5 years struggling with the question of agency and remedy. Was I in charge of this? Was it in charge of me? It was incredibly important for me as I experienced it that I kept reflecting on it as an agency that I was in possession of, so that I was able to administer my own treatment and come out the other end and have the hope of a recovery. But at the same time, I did experience it as something that was taking over my thinking, and I was hopeless up to a certain point.
Does viewing it as an addiction help to destigmatise drug use?
Well, I was a user in the 90s when there was a huge amount of heroin in Australia, and I was part of the cohort of people who were reviled in the streets. So my social isolation was extreme. People crossed the road to get away from me. And that, of course, fed into my emotional reasons for continuing to use. I suppose it would be useful if I thought I was ill, but I would categorise it, if anything, as more like a mental illness, like depression, which presumably has a relationship to addiction, which was treatable ultimately not even by antidepressants, not by psychotherapy, but by a psychological turn inside me. So the question of treatment, which obviously we're going to discuss at length, was for me quite complicated, because it ended up being a very haphazard grab bag of a whole lot of approaches.
If drug use is a disease, Mark, as I said, it's doctors that we turn to treat disease. That's and right. The way that they've tend to treat drug addiction, as you've pointed out, is that they prescribe drugs to replace the drugs that are doing you harm, particularly the opiates. So a heroin addict might be put on a methadone program or buprenorphine, or they might actually put a heroin addict on heroin, as they do in some countries around the world. You disregard this approach?
No, I don't disregard it. I think that it can help some people, and for people who really have an extremely difficult time getting off and changing their lives, it might be worthwhile to do that for a period of time, and even in some cases for a continuous period of time. I don't have any moral objections to that. I just think it's not the optimal approach. And that only works for opiates. So what are you going to do for methamphetamine addicts? What are you going to do for gambling addicts? And gambling addiction is really serious, and there's no drug that you can provide that's going to help with that. You know, I've gone to a couple of conferences recently on behavioral addictions, and I was shocked to see all these brain scans which showed that the behavioral addictions look exactly the same in your brain. So it's not about drugs. It's about a psychological process that can include drugs, and there is a double whammy because drugs are pretty powerful, but it could also include all those other things, gambling and sex and all the rest of it.
And Wayne, there is the physical addiction to the drug, and there's the psychological addiction. And frequently we find people get over the physical addiction, they're in the clear, but the psychological component draws them back to the drug. I would imagine that the psychological addiction is harder to get over than the physical addiction.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd agree with that. I mean, the drugs that have been developed that assist people get through the withdrawal syndrome, that the effects that people have, as Kate was describing, when they stop using their drug of dependence, particularly the opiates, it's unpleasant. We can treat the acute withdrawal syndrome. We can get people through that. It's staying stopped that is the challenge. And often it's not just a matter of not using the drug. It's often changing your friendship networks, changing what you do, where your life's headed. It requires often far-reaching changes, particularly if people have had a 5 or 10 year career of using heroin. They've been stigmatized. They've got a criminal track record. They've had no employment. It's going to be very, very difficult for them to dig themselves out of that hole and to get back into a life which is much more rewarding. So the emphasis on just treating the brain changes as a consequence of chronic drug use, really, it's just the beginning of a much more complicated story. And I think it's tended to focus too much on that. And if you look at the NIDA investment in the brain disease research, it's been enormously in looking for drugs to treat withdrawal and maintenance. And as Marcus said, the drugs that we've got available, a very, very small list, and certainly for the opiates, methadone and buprenorphine can be life-saving and help people stabilise, but they're not a magic bullet or a cure in that sort of sense. They're a beginning of a route out of a difficult situation for a lot of people.
Methadone was a route out for you, Kate, in the initial phase, is that right?
Well, look, I probably am typical and atypical in that I tried everything. I went to rehab. I went to extended rehab several times. I went to psychotherapy. I went to psychiatry first, antidepressants. Then I went to psychologists. I had ongoing counselling. My parents obviously were pulling out all the stops to get me help. We considered the Israeli method where you were sedated for weeks, apparently, and injected with various drugs. We went through everything. Eventually, I went on methadone, but I wasn't ready. I wasn't ready psychologically, emotionally at that stage, or circumstantially. So I was actually on methadone and heroin. What I ended up with was a double addiction, a much higher opiate tolerance, which would probably have killed me if I jumped off both of them. And then finally, a turn inside myself, which I
can you explain that to us? What you mean by that?
Well, look, I
an epiphany.
I wish I could explain it, Paul, because I still don't quite understand it. And I would love to be able to say to people, I did this, or this thought came to me. But one day I just woke up and I thought, I am so tired of this. It is so tiring and it is so boring. And if I say that, it sounds like, why didn't I just say that 3 years earlier? Why was I just so weak that I continued to use? But I really think that some process inside me had been going on. And I had a counsellor who was a wonderful, witchy old lady, and she said, there'll be a beginning, a middle and an end to this. And if you jump off too soon, you may relapse later on. Which wasn't permission to keep using, but she was just saying, be realistic about this. Something inside you has to develop. And what developed inside me, I suppose, was self-esteem, kind of psychological elements, which made me feel that I was up to the terrifying task of getting clean.
So in a sense, you treated yourself.
I did. Well, I went on methadone. As I said, I had a double addiction then.
Yeah.
And then I had a combination of circumstances and just this personal development. And it coincided, I have to say, with the end of the heroin, you know, surplus and the beginning of the great heroin drought of 2001, when just getting on was just so much more difficult and tiring and despair-making. And all of these things came together just at the right time. And I just thought, I can't do it. So I went on to methadone alone. It was very difficult. And I gave myself an incentive at the end, which I was going to do what they call do a geographical and leave the country. And then I just did it. I did it as hard as I could. I self-administered speed. So I used transition drugs, and then I did buprenorphine, which I understand Wayne was partly responsible for trialing in Australia. Thank you so much. And I just did it the hard way and came out the other end, ran away, came back a year later with a different state of mind.
What do you make of that, Mark? Is that a typical from what you've heard from the addicts you've spoken to, or does everybody have their own story about how they managed to circumvent their addiction?
Yeah, I think everybody has their own story. I have a blog. I've got about a couple of thousand former or recovering addicts, and people really do stop in very different ways, depending on who they are, what they're addicted to. For me, your story is not that different from mine. I also did it more or less on my own and tried different things, but I never used methadone or buprenorphine. I did continue to try until there was a psychological transformation that allowed me to say, I really hate this shit, and I really have to stop.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, that's a really important thing. Mm-hmm. So when I go through all this brain science in my book, I come up with a very humanistic recipe, which is utilize desire. Desire is a really powerful thing that organizes our thinking and our action. Utilize it when it's time to quit.
Is that the desire for a better life?
It does seem to be something biologically deterministic about the brain disease model, almost a sense of biological inevitability, when in fact the stories that we hear from addicts, Wayne, really go against the grain of that.
Well, I mean, the epidemiology, the study, if you look at following up large samples of representative parts of the population in drug use, then a lot of people who do get into difficulty with alcohol, tobacco, cannabis and other drugs do recover, and they do that, I mean, often with a struggle. It's not always easy. But I think there is a pessimism about the brain disease model that it doesn't say addiction can be a chronic relapsing condition. It says it is.
It is.
And it isn't. Yeah. For a lot of people, it isn't always a chronic relapsing.
A couple of other things you hear bandied around. One is the notion of the addictive personality, that there are some people who are more prone to addiction because they have an addictive personality. And secondly, that there is a genetic predisposition to addiction. Is there any truth in either of those two things?
Some, and they often go together, because some of these traits that predispose towards addiction are genetically transferred between generations. But that information is often really distorted. For example, a lot of the things that dispose towards addiction are personality traits, like impulsivity, risk-taking, frustration tolerance, having a low frustration tolerance. So you take these different personality traits, you stick them all together, and then you have a fairly high genetic loading, but that doesn't describe any single person. That's taking massive averages across many different studies, putting them together, and then, you know, pulling out a number from the top. So I think we have to look at that stuff and be aware of it, but look at it with caution. What is much more obvious are the environmental factors, the environmental forces, going through hard times. You know, life can be tough. Life can be really nasty. And people who start taking drugs or get addicted to other things are probably not feeling very good. Probably they're suffering from depression, anxiety, or some unfortunate incidents in their life that push them in this direction.
Across Australia, this is Big Ideas on RN and online. Paul Barclay with you, discussing drugs and addiction with Professor Mark Lewis, a developmental neuroscientist, author and former drug addict. Author Kate Holden, a former heroin addict and sex worker, and Professor of Addiction Neuroethics Wayne Hall from the University of Queensland's Centre for Clinical Research and the Brain Institute. Back to the conversation. Mark, in your memoirs of an addicted brain, you tell us about how you started to take drugs when you were a teenager at a boarding school that you hated. It was a miserable experience. Yeah. I remember talking to you about this when the book came out a couple of years ago. Was depression the reason that you started using drugs?
Yes, in a word, yes. It was depression. For me, it was depression and some anxiety, which often go together. So in that book, I traced my trajectory into addiction and through addiction and finally out of addiction. In the present book, The Biology of Desire, even though it's got some neuroscience in it, it's mostly also about stories, and I use other people's stories. So I tell the stories of five addicts, each of whom I've interviewed in a lot of depth, and it's really interesting to look at the commonalities between our stories and also the differences. They're both extremely informative.
You speak to Brian, the entrepreneur who gets hooked on meth, the social worker who steals and swallows, I think, prescription opiates.
He was the one who was into methamphetamine. Oh, yes, and the woman, yes, Donna, who was into...
Yeah. And Johnny, the Irishman, who was the alcoholic, right?
That's right, yeah.
How did you get their stories? Tell us a bit about that and why you chose... I think there's five stories that you focus on in your book.
That's right, Yeah, I wanted to write another book combining brain with story. I mean, there's only so much brain stuff you can do in a book, and it's pretty light. Mm. But the stories seem critical because that's really what gets the message across. So I put up a message on my blog. I sent a call for help to my readers and said, would anybody like to contribute their story and let me tell your biography in detail in a book? And I got like 150 responses. It took me a year to go through them all. It was an amazing pouring out of, well, people do like to tell their stories, you know. Mm. I just picked the people who were most articulate, who could be most candid, most honest about themselves, and who had good memories, good explicit memories of what it was like.
Middle-class drug users, really, aren't they? And they've all successfully shaken their addiction, too.
They were all more or less middle-class. Natalie, maybe not so much, the one who did heroin and ended up in prison. But, yeah, they'd all shaken their addictions.
Yeah.
By the time I finished talking to them, one was also an eating disordered person. Mm. She had a serious binge eating disorder, which also shows many of the same brain patterns. And she was still struggling a bit, but she more or less got the upper hand.
Now, Kate, tell me if I'm creating a cliche about your upbringing, but you came from a happy, functional, middle-class Melbourne background.
Yep.
You were studious. You had a tight family.
Yeah.
And your drug taking started, as many people in Melbourne's drug taking starts, around the streets of St Kilda. You'd finished uni. Was it the allure of being wild and dangerous and interesting that got you into this scene?
Yeah, pathetically probably it was, to be honest. I was pretty naive. I was shy. I was dorky. I came from a very stable family, very secure, lots of love, all of those things. I had no abuse. I had no kind of dysfunction in my past. Depression runs in my family. But I encountered heroin when it came in a big way into Melbourne, just as I was 24 and finishing university with not much idea of what lay ahead. And my boyfriend started taking it. I was terrified. I was horrified. The visceral horror of encountering this so close to me, mixing with my, you know, young student interest in the forbidden and the transgressive and the dark and the dangerous and glamorous. And I went from feeling that I was horrified by what he was doing to I want to know why he can do it. And he and his friends were just like me, but there they were, they'd crossed this line, and I wanted to know why they had the courage to do it, how it came to be experienced. So I asked to try it, really, so I could prove to them that it wasn't going to be any good. And it didn't work. It's not like the movies. Heroin doesn't send you swooning back into this, you know, orgasmic kind of bliss.
I was going to ask you about this. I don't imagine that you ever forget the first time that you shoot up heroin.
It was very ritualistic. We were taken separately into a bedroom, and there was a single lamp, and someone fixed it all up and said, hold out your arm. It was hieratic. Mm. It was like a religious ceremony, very imbued with exclusiveness and all that kind of drama.
And did that appeal to you, that notion
Absolutely.
Of being invited into a club?
Oh, absolutely. It was not that people said, come and have a go. They said that they said, go home, you don't want to see this. You're not cool enough for this. You know, this isn't for you. So naturally, I barreled in there. I remember having a fantasy, though, that I could even engineer an overdose for myself to prove to everyone else in the group how dangerous this was. I was so torn. I didn't set out to be a heroin addict, obviously. I'm a smart middle-class girl. But I think that was part of the danger for me, which was that I imagined I could be smarter than it. And I went romping in there with my middle-class educated friends, and we all tripped over quite fast, not into the physical dependency, which takes quite a long time to develop, but into the social, you know, addiction to it almost, so that became our activity, and nothing was as fun without getting on. And before we knew it, the struts were falling out from under our lives. We couldn't pay our bills. We were isolating from our other friends. We were caught up in this thing. And heroin, I think, like a lot of other drugs, has a fantastically economical poetry to it, which is that it gradually replaces everything else in your life. As you say, the brain networks simply start kind of disappearing. And so everything it takes away from you, your family, your money, your jobs, your, you know, self-esteem, your social standing, it just cozily replaces as the ultimate comfort. And for me, it was obviously just a combination of deep psychological anxieties and desire to be cool and all those kind of cliches.
Have you unpacked those deep psychological anxieties now? Did you need to unpack them to get over it?
Well, that's the thing, is once you're in, you're so tired. I had no time for psychotherapy. I was exhausted. And I was terrified. I was living on a razor edge of terror all the time, which really blinds you to other possibilities. And I was terrified of what was going to happen to me, especially because people kept saying, you're doomed, you'll be dead in a year, you'll be in jail in 2 years. So I was constantly fending off this existential vortex. And then also the fear, which I think is not often acknowledged, which is the terror of what will happen when you stop using, and what happens when you no longer have this comfort that you've built into your life, that you've become so familiar with, which is the only thing you have left because everyone else hates you now. And of course, heroin, when you stop using it, doesn't throw you a party, it tries to kill you. It makes you feel so violently terrible that obviously your impulse is to go back on.
Wayne, what do we know about why we desire drugs? I mean, we have There's the legal drugs, the cigarettes and alcohol. There's the prescription drugs, which are legal if you have a prescription, and then they flip over and become illegal if you consume the same drugs without a prescription. And then there are the illegal drugs that are always illegal. But in a sense, if you put them all together, there wouldn't be many people in the room today who haven't taken some drug that has some mind-changing component to it, and there would not be a society, I'm guessing, in the history of humankind that has not taken drugs. Why do we desire them? Why do we need them?
Well, the sort of reasons that Mark's given. I mean, they produce pleasurable effects. That's why people take them and why they get seduced into continuing to take them. And certainly, Mark said, and I think Kate has mentioned as well, depression. I mean, it's a miscarried attempt to deal with sadness, anxiety, depression. People get involved with alcohol for that sort of reason. They get involved with opiates. They get involved with stimulants. All of those drugs make people feel good in the short term. The trap often is you become a regular user. You require tolerance to the effects of the drug. You need larger doses. You rapidly sort of evolve into a pattern of regular use. Becomes an integral part of your routine, as Kate's described it, and life becomes very difficult without it. And particularly if you're in a social network where all your friends and peers are doing the same. There isn't a clear way to escape from that, and it just seems a normal routine thing to do.
You know, when I was using, we often bandied around this idea that we were kind of self-medicating, that shy people take coke to get, you know, sparkly, and people like me, you know, are kind of introverted, dreamy, artistic types tend to take heroin because it knocks the rough edges off life, which is too bad, you know, and this is an accessible idea that we liked, but is there anything in that?
Well, it's certainly one of the leading views, and I think Mark describes in his book the self-medication hypothesis of addiction. And if you look at the sort of evidence from the studies following up large representative cohorts, including the Victorian one that George Patton and colleagues have done, then certainly depression and anxiety is a common route into alcohol and other drug problems.
Because I know people who tried heroin and they've spewed. I mean, they just spent the night vomiting and yet they went back for more. I didn't like it the first time. It did nothing for me, but I had psychological drivers to keep going.
Well, same with tobacco. I had a 20, well, not almost 20-year history of daily cigarette smoking. I remember when I first started, I was ill, I fainted, and I had an older peer saying, well, that goes away after a while. You just got to keep
push
at
through.
It.
That's right, push through.
And you get the, yeah, and I think there are very few drugs that people's initial experiences are wholly positive, and I think the stimulants are probably one of the few.
But this brings up the other question, the other curious question of how can it be that some people seem to be able to control their use of even extremely addictive drugs without becoming addicted to them, whereas others can't? Do we need to go into the brain to discover this, or are there other reasons that help us understand this, Mark?
Yeah, you can do it either way. The statistics show that most people who use drugs do not get addicted. That's the first thing. And that includes alcohol. Most people don't. They go through it and they stop. Explore, stop. And then the second statistic is that most people who become addicted to drugs get off them. Those aren't the ones you necessarily read about in the newspaper, but most addicts quit, and they quit anywhere. It could be 6 months, it could be 6 years, it could be 20 years, but most quit. And the third really cool statistic is that most people who quit, quit without any form of formal treatment.
Interesting, isn't it?
Isn't it? It's amazing. So, you know, people have all kinds of resilience built into them, and I think for some people, it's early on, they say, yeah, I can see where this is going, not for me, thanks. And for other people, they need to hit a couple of hard knocks and shit, I'm really getting kind of to like this stuff too much. And that's when they go over. So that's the psychological part. The neural part always reflects the psychological part. You know, but well, some of the things you said are important. The notion of predisposing personality traits, which can have something to do with the particular kind of dopamine receptors you have in particular brain areas, how good your particular brain is at how sensitive it is to serotonin and a whole bunch of other neuromodulators, neurochemicals. Well, our brains are a little bit different from each other, yes, and that does indeed affect how strongly drugs, the impact, how strong the impact is of the drugs, and how much, shall we say, how much you can draw on your prefrontal cortex, your judgment, decision-making, perspective-taking, insight, all that good stuff that we're so proud of, how much you can draw on that to say, this is not a good idea.
If we look at someone like Kate, who even in the depths of her addiction we would still see someone who had something to live for, someone who is smart, comes from a caring family, she had her writing. It's possible for Kate to see a future even in the depths of her addiction. What of addicts who cannot imagine a better future, for whom outside of that addiction lies a violent, abusive relationship, unemployment, low self-esteem? Drugs offer them an escape, and it would seem to me there's little disincentive for them to stop taking those drugs.
I think you're right. Carl Hart has written about that, and Chasing the Scream, to some degree. Rat Park, the famous study that showed that rats that live in isolated steel cages prefer morphine to sucrose. But when you take those rats and you move them into a common area with stuff to play with and other rats to socialize with, they stop. Even those who have become addicted to morphine, self-addicted to morphine, will stop taking the morphine, move back onto the sucrose solution, go through withdrawal symptoms, because it's more fun to hang out with your buddies and play than it is to, you know, suck on morphine all day. And yeah, the same thing goes on in human society. Environment makes a big difference. People have talked about that for a while. The disease model doesn't pay very much attention to that, which is really unfortunate. And I think this issue of resources for recovery is extremely important. You need to have something to live for. You need to have some way to reconnect with the world. You need to have some financial resources so that you can go back to school or that you can buy some clothes for that job interview. Those factors are important.
If that is true, it means that the success rates of shaking addiction among the middle class are going to be terribly much higher than those from poor, disenfranchised groups of people.
Yeah, and I don't know the stats on that, but that is how it seems.
Do we have stats on that one?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's any doubt that people who come from socially disadvantaged backgrounds do find it harder to disengage. And I think they're much more likely to end up in the criminal justice system because they don't have the skills to earn money to support drug use. So they usually get involved in dealing or stealing.
Right.
They end up in the criminal justice system. I don't think the other thing we don't want to underestimate is the death rate, particularly amongst people with serious forms of addiction who do end up in the criminal justice system, particularly the opiates. There's a lot of overdose deaths and suicide. I think, you know, one of the consequences of people do get desperate enough and they can't see a way out, they take their own life. And so there are elevated rates of suicide amongst seriously addicted people, particularly suicide rates among people with alcohol problems are higher than they are amongst people with depression in some way. So I don't think we should underestimate how, you know, the sort of mortality around the more serious forms of addiction of people who don't have the sort of social support and other things that enable them to get out of their predicament.
Kate, did you have a sense that there was a future for you, even in those dark moments of addiction?
Well, I was perpetually in this, you know, in this chasm of fear, as I was saying, and that is very preoccupying. And I certainly, there were times
was
where
the fear,
I imagined...
Sorry, was the fear stopping you from taking the drugs or keeping
it
you
was
taking the drugs?
Both. I think I was, you know, caught between these two kind of whirling, you know, darknesses and just kind of being like a bit like a, to use an inappropriate metaphor, like a car going through a car wash, you know. And I was so occupied by just simple survival and my, you know, shame and embarrassment, humiliation, you know, the kind of mess I got myself into, and aghast. Like, how could this be happening to me? Every morning I woke up with that jolt of, oh my God, no, that's right, this is my life. And that both kept me in it because it was so exhausting, but also kept me imagining that the shock was indicating that I still had an idea of a better life. And what happened is I actually started missing my books. You know, I'm such a swotty middle-class girl, but I miss my books. I miss that part of me that was creative and expressive and wasn't just driving, you know, down the same road every day towards a dealer. And so for me, I came to feel that it was an aberration where I was, that this was, you know, in a sense, looking back, I was slumming it, and that there was a possibility. I had a family who was keeping faith with me, which was absolutely crucial. I think above any other terror was my terror that my family would reject me. And I had my education and I had so on, but at the same time I knew that people weren't going to look kindly on a, you know, a former heroin user. And also I was working in the sex industry, which had its own kind of stigmas. But for me, it was possible. My partner in the later part of my use was, by contrast, someone who'd started using at 13, using hard drugs, you know, by 14, and had a horribly dysfunctional family background, abusive, and had been using it all his adult life. That was his way of life. I left him. We parted ways as part of my survival. But coming back to, into contact with him years later, I discovered that he had, without any support, without any family, without any of the advantage that I had, got himself into a program and, in fact, was training to be a drug and rehab counsellor himself. Now, he has, I think, had issues with relapse, but by and large, he has managed to get himself on the straight and narrow. So it's not impossible for people to do it, but he obviously had to pull on a lot of more internal resources.
So, Mark, I was speaking to Norman Doidge recently, who you referred to, about some astonishing case studies that he's done recently of neuroplasticity in his new book, of the brain's ability to, as he described it, heal itself.
Yeah.
People with autism, with chronic pain, those recovering from stroke, with MS, all to some extent have been able to consciously rewire their brains in ways we simply didn't think possible years ago. It required huge diligence and motivation on their part, but the results seem to speak for themselves. Can addicts rewire their brain to get over their addiction?
Yeah, absolutely. That's something I really stress in my book. In the last chapter, I use an example of the some people are born with webbed fingers. Their fingers are connected, and they can't move them independently. And then they could have those fingers surgically separated like that through an operation. When that happens, before it happens, the brain circuits and the sensory motor cortex are treating those fingers as those two fingers as if they're one finger. And after the operation, it takes only 2 to 3 weeks for the brain to start to reorganize itself so that that part of the cortex is now sending some fibers to that finger and other fibers to that finger. So you see, the analogy is it's a great analogy. Think about my wish for, desire for drugs is fused with my desire for happiness and my sense of what's going to make me fulfilled. And then you separate those things because it doesn't. It doesn't work. And you recognize that it doesn't work and you say, this is shit, this is not making me happy, it's making me miserable. And as soon as you do that separation in your life and in your thoughts and your activities, the brain rewires itself in the same sort of way. It's so good at this. This emphasis on neuroplasticity is, you know, we recognize it when people have strokes and concussions. We know the brain rewires itself after a concussion or a stroke. Why not recognize that it can do that after just about any negative consequence?
Even like your subconscious brain, I don't know if you experience this, Mark, but to this day I still occasionally have a recurring dream which is about don't do it. Yeah. And it's a dream in which I'm walking down a street full of filled syringes. They're thick on the ground. In my dream I walk and walk going, no, 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 no. And then eventually I'm so tired of resisting that I pick one up and I'm about to inject it and I wake up and every single time I think, oh, thank God, it was just a dream. Yeah. It's a moral parable provided to me by my subconscious just to say, remember, it would be terrible. You would feel very bad.
I was thinking about this brain disease model of addiction and going with it, this sense of almost powerlessness over your addiction. I wondered, Mark, how much the rise and success of Alcoholics Anonymous in the middle of last century helped to establish this notion of drug and alcohol dependency as something we're powerless to control. I think that they used to emphasise the fact that it was biological and genetic. You'll always be an addict till the day that you die. Do you think did that in some way inform this disease model?
It started it. The words like malady, allergy were words they used a long time ago. But they didn't do it on their own. The AA model got fused with the medical model in the U.S., and that's when they started treating addiction with residential treatment programs, and they'd bring people in, keep them there for 30 to 60 to 90 days. So it's a very controversial issue. AA doesn't necessarily, is not to blame for the disease model per se, but it's this fusion between the rehab industry, AA, and the medical voices and research community all together that have created this monster, I think, you know, out of all these parts.
This is Big Ideas on RN, online, via podcast, and on your mobile through the ABC Radio app. Tonight, we're talking about drugs, addiction, and the brain, a conversation recorded at the Brisbane Writers' Festival. Our speakers are Dr. Mark Lewis, developmental neuroscientist, author and former drug addict, author Kate Holden, a former heroin addict and sex worker, and Wayne Hall, professor of addiction neuroethics from the University of Queensland.
There's another interesting study that, Wayne, you pointed to in an article you sent me. in terms of recovery from addiction. How do we explain the high rate of recovery in the follow-up studies of heroin-addicted Vietnam veterans in the US?
Well, there's a number of reasons. I think one, the big one is the huge change in environment. You know, people were using a drug under wartime conditions where it was readily available and very cheap, and they went back to a situation where it wasn't as available. Their circumstances changed. They went back to more, they had more social support, and a lot of the reasons for their involvement in using opiates were no longer there. I think the other thing is that they probably, more recent work looking at what went on in Vietnam, there probably wasn't as much heavy heroin use as it wasn't by injection, for example. They were smoking, much less dependence potential from that particular route of administration. So, I mean, a lot of so-called lessons have been drawn from the Vietnam veterans study. There was certainly a huge panic on the part of Nixon and others that they were going to be overwhelmed by a flood of addicted Vietnam veterans. They did have substantial problems with heroin, but nowhere near as many. And the Robin study that I sent you is the one that followed up 3 years later and found surprisingly few people had persisted in heroin use. And those that had were people who had a history of drug problems before they went into the military.
So, Kate, it's not really possible to talk about drugs and addiction without talking about the fact that drug use is criminalised in Australia and other jurisdictions. What purpose do you think is served by criminalising drug use and addiction?
Well, I think it serves as a panacea to people who want things to be simple in life. Some people are drawn to simple, you know, solutions and formulations, and some people aren't. But I think it's an operation of a really deep thing, and I'm kind of taking the part of the psychological person on this panel, I guess. But I think that there is a great element othering which happens in drug use. And when I say that, I mean that when you are confronting your kind of perverse desires, your, you know, bad behaviour, your ruthlessness and so on, you find a part of yourself which you don't recognise. And this is unbelievably confronting. You know, I'm a nice person. Why am I suddenly lying, cheating, stealing? You know, who have I turned into? I'm screaming at my mother. Who am I, you know, looking at in the mirror? And you find this otherness in yourself. That's confronting. I think when people who love you see you, they see another person, they say, that's not my son, he would never behave like that. You know, that's not my husband, he would never have, you know, stolen, you know, the kids' money.
Did the fact that heroin was illegal deter you in any way from using
it? No. Look, what I'm getting at really is I think it's the same thing as going on sociologically, is that it's very, as in one reason, is it's really convenient to make people who are addicts or behaving in a certain way other, and one of the best ways is to criminalise them. It's very kind of placating. Then everyone can say that, oh, that's okay, we have a remedy for that, we put them in jail or we fine them or whatever it is that we do. It doesn't stop the addiction in any way, as far as I can tell. People in jail obviously are using drugs and then unsupervised. Obviously the black market kind of thing comes up. My life as a heroin addict, to say it quickly, was immeasurably more appalling because heroin was illegal. It was appalling in every dimension because of that fact.
Wayne, 14 years ago, in the face of huge political opposition, a medically supervised drug injecting room was open in King's Cross. There had been many overdose deaths leading up to the establishment of this room, and there was much concern about heroin use. In fact, the concern about heroin use back then rather parallels the concern around ICE today. In the 14 years that injecting centre has been operating, there has not been a single fatal overdose. Now the idea has been floated of an ICE room operating on similar principles, where people could go into a safe, medically supervised ICE room and use methamphetamine. Is there any merits in that idea?
Look, I think there's a big difference between stimulants and opiates. And I think in supervised injecting rooms, heroin treatment programs, methadone treatment programs make a lot of sense for opiates in helping to stabilise people's lives, avoid the sort of alternating between intoxication and withdrawal. The stimulants, people don't use them in the same way as opiates. I think the idea of people coming into a room and just smoking a bit of methamphetamine and then sort of chilling out in the way people do after they've injected heroin, and it doesn't make sense. I know I was involved in the WHO evaluations, the Swiss heroin trials, and in some Swiss cities they had big problems with heroin and cocaine, and there was some sort of flirtation with the idea of allowing people to self-administer cocaine, and they decided that the stimulant drugs, people just got too chaotic, were more inclined to binge and become quite disturbed, and it didn't make sense. It made a lot more sense to do that for an opiate than it does for a stimulant. Mm. I mean, if it was to be done, I think we'd have to look carefully at whether there was value in it, but I'd be surprised if it made as much sense for a drug like methamphetamine as it would for heroin or opiates.
Mark, meth use in Australia has gone up. There's a degree of, without playing down the problem, there's a degree of almost hysteria around it at the moment politically. Yeah. There are new penalties that have been introduced in New South Wales for the manufacture and supply of it. Mm. Any thoughts about how we treat methamphetamine use? What might work there, given that, as Wayne has said, it's quite a different drug from the opiates?
You know, as Kate says, there's a drug-taking culture that goes with each type of drug, I guess, and meth use goes with a pretty wild culture. It's pretty unsavory. Mm. Part of the deal is you stay up for many nights. You stay up, you know, you basically miss 2, 3, 4, 5 or more nights of sleep, which makes you go a bit crazy. You have sleep deprivation, so you go a bit psychotic. It's not just the drug, it's the sleep deprivation. Well, yeah, I can see how that's really disturbing to a society, and truthfully, I don't know. I don't know what I would do about it, but I would probably try to get in there and try to use some kind of peer discussion or peer alterations, modifications to help meth users see that you don't have to do it this way. There's other ways to do it. You don't have to go crazy just because you're taking this drug.
Yeah, and just really quickly, I'm going to have to hand back to Sarah in a sec. Kate, they say once an addict, always an addict, and they talk about one day at a time, all of that. How close do you feel, how far away do you feel from the prospect of relapse now, all these years?
Yeah,
later?
It's 15 years since I last touched heroin.
Yep.
That's not actually a long time. I know people relapse after 20, 30 years occasionally, but I don't see that happening for me. I live in St Kilda still. I see the fits on the ground. I see people stoned. And I have a huge pity for them. I have sometimes a bit of contempt sometimes and impatience with their behaviour. And really, I feel just such sorrow for the difficulties they're going through and their social isolation. And I don't see myself ever picking it up again.
Whereas you, Mark, had some oxytocin for a back complaint.
Oxycontin.
Yeah. For a back complaint.
Yeah.
And I know, and we talked about this last time you were here,
yeah.
And you did get rather worried that you could have quite easily got addicted again.
You know, there's a sensitization. I compare it to when I see an email pop up on my screen from my ex-wife, I still get a flutter, right? Well, I haven't loved this person in many, many years. And if my current wife knew that I still get this...
You're comfortable with this analogy that you're still working with?
No, but, there's I devoted a lot of synapses to that person many years ago.
Yeah.
And I've devoted a lot of synapses to pharmaceutical opiates, too. So I still feel some of the old feelings. Yes, I do. Some of the attraction. But getting on it now I've had two back surgeries. Unfortunately, I've had another one since then.
Oh, cool.
Although I'm in great shape now. I've got zero pain, so I'm not complaining. The attraction's there, yeah, it's okay, this is going to feel good. Oh, yeah, it does feel good, just like it used to. And then it's gone a day or two. It's like, man, this is boring. I can't believe that I did this day after day and went to such great lengths to get it because it doesn't feel that way anymore. It's just not like that anymore.
That was a discussion on addiction and drugs recorded at the Brisbane Writers' Festival. I was speaking to developmental neuroscientist and Professor Dr. Mark Lewis, a former drug addict and author. You also heard from Wayne Hall, professorial and NHNMRC Australia Fellow in Addiction Neuroethics at the University of Queensland's Centre for Clinical Research and the Brain Institute, and Kate Holden, an author and former heroin addict and sex worker. Book details for Mark and Kate's books are on the Big Ideas website. Until tomorrow, I'm Paul Barclay. Bye for now.